Welcome back to the Hemingway List. It's the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Sorry about last night's episode being so late. I apparently forgot to press submit on the episode. And so I woke up in the morning, went about my day, got myself a gun. However the rest of the song to The Sopranos goes, and then it was only later in the day when I found out that I'd forgotten to post it, forgotten to submit the thing. So I'm very sorry about that. I'm also stalling because I'm opening my pages. Hey, here's something cool. Nifty-rific, Reddit user Nifty-rific, will be guest starring on the podcast tomorrow, and I think even the next day as well. Nifty-rific will be reading chapter 23 and chapter 24. Pretty cool. I'll still be doing the conversation part of the podcast, but we'll have Nifty-rific doing the reading. Little guest spot. Thanks very much, Nifty-rific, by the way, for sending in that message and offering to do that. Pretty nice of you. Looking forward to that. Today we're going to talk about chapter 21 of Anna Karenina. Are things back to normal for Oblinsky and Kitty? Now, someone pointed out that I in fact meant to say Dolly. Who was that? Swim said the mama fishy. Yes, I did mean to say Dolly. Are things back to normal for Oblinsky and Dolly? Question two. What the hell is Vronsky doing there, here? And favourite line from this chapter. Thermos of Beer said, I apologise in advance for this, but Vronsky showing up and leaving right away reminded me of an episode of That 70s Show where Eric Foreman was going to different houses trying to find a place to poo. So I can't help but picture Vronsky in a carriage when something inside him gurgles, then shifts, demanding to be released at once. Him praying that only Steva is home as he pulls up to the Oblinsky residence, and frightened look of is the horror washing over him that all the women are here and this is no safe place to poo. I doubt this is the case with a literary classic, but if this doesn't get explained, then this is what I'm choosing to believe. I think that's got to be it. I'm taking that as That's canon, and that's what happened. Syntax approval said brilliant. I Am Norwegian says, are things back to normal for Oblinsky and Dolly? I wonder. We've never seen their normal, but the jokes and sly smiles seem to indicate that they've both dropped the walls between them. What the hell is Vronsky doing here? At first I assumed that he was there to ask Kitty to marry him or something. But then I thought he might have been there for Anna instead. Either way, it seems like his high society instincts kicked in and told him to get the hell out of there, using the dinner as pretext for being there. Edit. Anda. You had an impression of Alexandria Daddario as unattractive, old and frumpy? Here is some counter evidence. She won't look out of place in Russia either. I'm keeping the photos PG, but you should check out True Detective. Pervy face. Did I read the reverse of what you meant into that? Ah, you kind of did. First of all, I'm looking at the three pictures of, what's her name? Alexandria Daddario that you've linked. I know exactly who she is, but I'm just looking at them for fun. She is insanely attractive. What I was trying to say is I thought Anna Karenina was frumpy, old, and unattractive. I don't know why. Just those opening chapters, I just thought she was like this Mary Poppins lady. That's what I meant. I didn't mean Alexandria Daddario was any of those things. She's insanely hot. Insanely hot. Not even a thing. She's in True Detective, is she? Okay, very cool. Yeah, no, I don't know why. I don't know why how I got that wrong, but I thought Anna Karenina was like an old nanny lady or something like that. At first, not now, but in that first introduction to her, something made me think that. Cephalopod Surprise said, "Not entirely normal. Steva is still holding back his natural tendencies, as he did not want to know that he had forgotten his guilt after being forgiven. But it will be back to normal when he's back to his full-on jovial, chubby self." I'm with Thermos of Beer, says Cephalopod as well. The man is looking for a bathroom. What did they use back then? Outhouses? Bedpans? Garderobes? Can't blow up the privy with Kitty, Anna and Dolly all hanging around. Favourite line? I liked the line that ended with, "Next came the booming voice of Stepan Arkadyevich, asking him to come in, and the quiet, soft and calm voice of Vronsky refusing. It reinforces the idea that we pretty much know Steva, and after he's making up with Dolly, there isn't much he's hiding, except maybe that visitor from Matvey told him about earlier in the book, from the livery stable. I don't know if they revealed what that was about, and I just don't trust quiet, calm Vronsky." Sluggy with 3G says, "It seems like they are back to whatever their normal is, but I can't help but feel that it is only temporary. We know that Steva doesn't love Dolly anymore, and he never really even felt repentance for cheating on her, just guilt at getting caught. As the relationships between characters continue to develop, I always think back to the first line of the novel and wonder how they are uniquely unhappy. In this case, they are engaged in this marriage where Steva no longer loves Dolly, while she is resentful of his actions and he treats her, and neither situation seems like it is resolved by this." What was Vronsky doing? It's hard to know his motivations at this point. It seems either like he was there to see Kitty or got spooked when he saw Anna again, or he used seeing Kitty as a pretext to see Anna and thought better of it at the last moment. Mini L said, "I don't think things are back to normal. They may be talking to each other again and acting normal, but I don't think Dolly feels normal at all about their marriage. Things might get better with time, but definitely not this fast." And what's Vronsky doing? That's what I was wondering, but I think Anna might have an idea. Gwynardle says, to quote one of the Love Actually writers, they stay together, but home isn't as happy as it once was. I think they are as normal as they will ever be, given the situation. Vronsky is seriously creepy. I think he has a thing for Anna and can't get her out of his head. Also, I know this was yesterday's prompt, but I keep thinking of who I am picturing as Anna, and the closest actress I can think of is Dagmara Dominczyk, who played Mercedes in the 2002 Count of Monte Cristo adaptation. Jeez, can you get more obscure with these people? I'm looking at her picture and thinking, no, I don't know who that is. But thank you. Henry Loz says, I don't know what Vronsky is doing there, but I loved the naivety of Kitty, where she concluded that he left because he saw Anna, and it was not right for him to visit when Anna was present. I think she will find Vronsky's real motivation soon. Hopefully it won't be too late. Alright, very good. That's the conversation bit of the podcast. Done. Now I'm going to read you chapter 22. I'm sorry, it's really late. I didn't mean to stay up so late before doing this, so I'm a little bit half asleep, if it sounds like I'm talking funny. Chapter 22 goes like this. The ball had only just begun when Kitty and her mother ascended the broad staircase, which was deluged with light, decorated with flowering plants, and occupied by powdered footmen in red liveries. From the ballroom, as from a beehive, came the regular sound of movement, and while they were arranging their hair and dresses before a mirror on the landing between the plants, they heard the accurate measured sound of the orchestra, violins just beginning the first waltz. A little old man who had smoothed the grey hair on his temples before another mirror and who smelt strongly of scent, happened to jostle them on the stairs and stepped aside in evident admiration of Kitty, whom he did not know. A beardless youth, one of those whom the old Prince Shcherbatsky called puppies, with a low-cut waistcoat, straightening his white tie as he went along, bowed to them and ran past, but returned to ask Kitty for a quadrille. She had given the first quadrille to Vronsky and had to give the second to this youth. An officer, buttoning his gloves, stood aside at the doorway to make room for them, and smoothing his moustache, looked with evident pleasure at the rosy Kitty. Although Kitty's gown and coiffure and all her other adornments had given her much trouble and thought, she now entered the ballroom in her complicated dress of white net over a pink slip, as easily and simply as if these bows and laces, and all the details of her toilet had not cost her or her people a moment's attention. As if she had been born in this net and lace, and with that high coiffure, and the rose and its two leaves on the top. When, just before entering the ballroom, her mother wished to put straight a twisted end of her sash, Kitty drew slightly back. She felt that everything on her must be naturally right and graceful, and that there was no need to adjust anything. It was one of Kitty's happy days. Her dress did not feel tight anywhere. The lace around her bodice did not slip. The bows did not crumple or come off. The pink shoes with their high curved heels did not pinch, but seemed to make her feet lighter. The thick rolls of fair hair kept up as if they had grown naturally, so on the little head, All three buttons on each of her long gloves, which fitted without changing the shape of her hand, fastened without coming off. The black velvet ribbon of her locket clasped her neck with unusual softness. That ribbon was charming, and when Kitty had looked at her neck in the glass at home, she felt that ribbon was eloquent. There might be some possible doubt about anything else, but that ribbon was charming. Kitty smiled here at the ball when she caught sight of it again in the mirror. Her bare shoulders and arms gave her a sensation of a cold marble, a feeling like she liked very much. Her eyes shone, and she could not keep her rosy lips from smiling at the consciousness of her attractive appearance. Before she had reached the light-coloured crowd of women in tulle, ribbons and lace, who were waiting for partners, Kitty never long formed one of the crowd, she was already asked for the waltz, and asked by the best dancer, the leader of the dancing hierarchy, the famous dirigeur and master of the ceremonies, a handsome, stately married man, George Korsunsky. He had just left the Countess Bonin, with whom he had danced the first round of the waltz, and looking round his domain, that is to say, a few couples who had begun to dance, he noticed Kitty just coming in. He approached her with that peculiar free and easy amble natural only to masters of ceremonies, bowed, and without even asking her consent, put his arm around her slim waist. She looked about for someone to hold her fan, and the mistress of the house took it from her with a smile. "How fine that you have come in good time," he said, with his arm around her waist. "It's wrong of people to come so late." Bending her left arm, she put her hand on his shoulder, and her little feet in their pink shoes began moving quickly, lightly and rhythmically, in time with the music over the smooth parquet floor. "It is a rest to waltz with you," he said, as he took the first slow steps of the dance. "What lightness and precision. It's delightful," he remarked, saying to her what he said to almost all the dancing partners whom he really liked. She smiled at his praise, and over his shoulder continued to survey the ballroom. She was not a girl just come out, for whom all faces at the ball blend into one fairy-like vision. Nor was she a girl who had been dragged from ball to ball till all faces were familiar to dullness. She was between those two extremes, and though elated, was able to control herself sufficiently to be observant. She saw that the elite of the company were grouped in the left-hand corner of the room. There was the beauty leader, Kornunsky's wife, in the impossibly low dress, and the hostess, and there shone the bald head of Kriven, who was always where the elite were. Youths who had not the courage to approach gazed in that direction, and there Kitty's eyes found Stephen, and then the lovely head and beautiful figure of Anna in a black velvet dress, and he was there. Kitty had not seen him since the day she had refused Levin. With her far-sighted eyes, she recognized him at once, and even noticed that he was looking at her. "Shall we have another turn? You are not tired?" asked Kornunsky, who was a little out of breath. "No more turns, thank you. Where may I take you? I believe Anna Arkadyevna Karenina is here. Take me to her. Wherever you please." And Korsunsky waltzed towards the left of the room, gradually diminishing his steps and repeating, "Pardon, mesdames, pardon, mesdames," as he steered through that sea of lace, tulle, and ribbons without touching as much as a feather, and then turned his partner so suddenly that her delicate ankles in the open-work stockings appeared as her train spread out like a fan and covered Kriven's knees. Korsunsky bowed, straightened his broad shirt front, and offered Kitty his arm to conduct her to Anna. Kitty flushed and, a little giddy, took her train off Kriven's knees and looked around for Anna. Anna was not in lilac, the colour Kitty was so sure she ought to have worn, but in a low-necked black velvet dress which exposed her full shoulder and bosom that seemed carved out of old ivory, and her rounded arms with the very small hands. Her dress was richly trimmed with Venetian lace. In her black hair, all her own, she wore a little garland of pansies, and in her girdle, among the lace, a bunch of the same flowers. Her coiffure was very, very unobtrusive. The only noticeable things about it were the willful ringlets that always escaped at her temples and on the nape of her neck and added to her beauty. Round her finely chiseled neck, she wore a string of pearls. Kitty had been seeing Anna every day and was in love with her and had always imagined her in lilac, but seeing her in black, she felt that she had never before realized her full charm. She now saw her in a new and quite unexpected light. She now realized that Anna could not have worn lilac, and that her charm lay precisely in the fact that her personality always stood out from her dress, that her dress was never conspicuous on her, and her black velvet with rich lace was not at all conspicuous, but served only as a frame. She alone was noticeable, simple, natural, elegant, and at the same time merry and animated. She was standing among that group very erect as usual and was talking to the master of the house with her head slightly turned towards him when Kitty approached. "No, I am not going to throw the first stone." she was saying in reply to some question, adding with a shrug of her shoulders, "although I cannot understand it," and at once she turned to Kitty with a tender protecting smile. She surveyed Kitty's dress with a rapid feminine glance and with a movement of her head, scarcely perceptible but understood by Kitty, she signified her approval of Kitty's dress and beauty. "You even come into the room dancing," she said. "She is one of my most faithful helpers," said Korsunsky, turning to Anna, whom he had not yet seen. "The princess helps to make a ball gay and beautiful. Anna Arkadyevna, shall we have a turn?" he added, stooping towards her. "Oh, you know one another?" asked the host. "Whom do we not know? My wife and I are like white wolves. Everyone knows us," answered Korsunsky. "Anna Arkadyevna, just one turn." "I don't dance if it is possible not to," she said. "But tonight it is not possible," he rejoined. At that moment Vronsky approached. "Well, if it is impossible not to dance tonight, let us dance," she said, taking no notice of Vronsky's bow, and quickly putting her hand on Korsunsky's shoulder. Why is she displeased with him? Thought Kitty, noticing that Anna had intentionally taken no notice of Vronsky's bow. He came up to Kitty, reminding her of the first quadrille, and regretting that he had not seen her for such a long time. Kitty, while gazing with admiration at Anna waltzing, listened to him, expecting him to ask her to waltz, but he did not do so, and she glanced at him with surprise. He blushed and hurriedly asked her to dance. Asked her to dance. But scarcely had he put his arm around her slim waist and taken one step when the music stopped. Kitty looked into his face, which was so near her own, and for years after, that look of so full of love which she then gave him, and which met with no response from him, cut her to the heart with tormenting shame. "Pardon, pardon, a waltz, a waltz," shouted Korsunsky from the other end of the room, and seizing the first girl within reach, he himself began dancing. All right, there we go. That's another chapter down. Looking forward to tomorrow, having a little bit of a guest reader from Nifty Riffic. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.